From Feature Story News in Washington and our bureaus around the world, this is FSN Reports. I'm Kevin McAleese. On today's programme, the US condemns Russia's decision to send so-called aid trucks into eastern Ukraine.
This is a violation of Ukraine's sovereignty and territorial integrity by Russia. Russia must remove its vehicles and its personnel from the territory of Ukraine immediately. Failure to do so will result in additional costs and isolation.
Also today, why the use of mobile phones has been causing a stir in the arts world. And as the White House calls the murder of James Foley a terror attack, we look at how the US government should address the wider Islamic State threat.
I think we're entering the harder phase. It was somewhat easy for American air power to stop the ISIS advance, and now to try and roll it back, it'll be much more difficult. And I think we're in for a bit of a long slog.
That's coming up on FSN Reports after our latest summary of the day's headlines.
From Feature Story News in Washington, I'm Rebecca Foster. The Pentagon has said it's very concerned about the movement of a Russian convoy into eastern Ukraine, strongly condemning the action, which it says shouldn't be happening without the Ukrainian government's authorization. Russia says the convoy is a humanitarian mission, and President Putin has said further delays to the delivery of aid would be unacceptable. But U.S. Rear Admiral John Kirby said the action will increase tension in the area.
Russia should not send vehicles, persons, or cargo of any kind into Ukraine, whether under the guise of humanitarian convoys or any other pretext, without Kyiv's express permission. This is a violation of Ukraine's sovereignty and territorial integrity by Russia.
The convoy started to move into Ukraine without permission after being stalled at a border checkpoint for more than a week. According to Ukrainian President Petro Poroshenko, more than 100 trucks have crossed the border illegally so far, in flagrant violation of international law. Daria Bondarchuk has the details from Moscow.
The trucks began moving on Friday afternoon after Russian Foreign Ministry stated it could no longer wait to deliver the aid, blaming delays on the Ukrainian side. The convoy moved in without the Red Cross or Ukrainian escorts in violation of previously reached agreements between Moscow and Kyiv. The spokesperson of the International Committee of the Red Cross at the checkpoint of Donetsk on the Russian side of the border confirmed the organization was not accompanying or taking part in the mission. The Ukrainian State Security Chief Valentin Nerivaychenko called the advance of the convoy into Ukrainian territory a direct invasion by Russia.
Palestinian terrorist group Hamas says militants have executed 18 people they believed were collaborating with Israel. The move was an apparent retaliation for an Israeli airstrike that killed three Hamas leaders on Thursday. Sources from Hamas said the executions were carried out by an armed group called the Resistance. And in Iraq, at least 64 people have been killed during a suicide bomb attack in a mosque. The suicide bomber and gunman opened fire during Friday prayers at a Sunni mosque outside Baghdad. The attack comes as top American officials say Islamic State militants are the biggest threat the U.S. has faced in years. U.S. Defense Secretary Chuck Hagel said that the Islamic State would be a long-term threat to America and that the country must be prepared.
ISIL is as sophisticated and well-funded as any group that we have seen. They're beyond just a terrorist group. They marry ideology, a sophistication of strategic and tactical military prowess. They are tremendously well-funded. Oh, this is beyond anything that we've seen. So we must prepare for everything.
From bureaus worldwide, this is FSN. With the conflict in Syria now in its fourth year, the United Nations says the death toll recorded up until April is over 191,000. They warn this is probably an underestimate, with the UN's human rights chief Navi Pillay blaming international paralysis on the issue. William Denslow reports from UN headquarters in New York.
Figures released by the United Nations Human Rights Office are the first since July 2013, when the UN estimated more than 100,000 people had died in Syria. The report is based on findings from the Syrian government and four separate monitoring groups. Human Rights Chief Navi Pillay says the huge increase is because more killings from earlier periods have been included, as well as more recent deaths reported since the last update. Blaming the world's paralysis and lack of action in Syria, she says the conflict has dropped off the international radar, which has empowered the killers, destroyers, and torturers in the country.
And the Obama administration broke the law when it swapped five detainees held at Guantanamo Bay for the captured American serviceman Sergeant Bo Bergdahl. An independent government watchdog in Washington has rejected the White House's claim that exceptional circumstances forced it to act without reference to the U.S. Congress. Washington correspondent Simon Marks reports.
The Government Accountability Office says the law is clear and the White House broke it by failing to provide Congress with 30 days' notice of its intention to swap the five Guantanamo detainees for Sergeant Bergdahl. The Defense Department violated the law and spent government money that hadn't been appropriated for the transfer. The Obama administration has always claimed it had to act quickly in the face of a threat to Sergeant Bergdahl's life. But in a victory for Republicans who requested the opinion, the GAO rejects that claim.
And that's the latest from Feature Story News. Rebecca Foster reporting.
From Feature Story News in Washington, I'm Kevin McAleese. Welcome to FSN Reports.
We're in touch with the Ukrainian government. We will be in touch today with our partners at the UN Security Council to discuss next steps. Russia should take the opportunity to remove this convoy from within Ukraine. If they don't, they will face additional costs and consequences from the United States and our partners in the international community.
Deputy National Security Advisor Ben Rhodes responding after Ukrainian officials said their country was under a direct invasion from Russia. Petro Poroshenko, Ukraine's president, said Russia's decision to send a convoy of aid trucks into eastern Ukraine was a flagrant violation of international law. Some 70 trucks have crossed over, with another 200 still stationed near the border. Russia issued a strong warning against disrupting the convoy, insisting it was a humanitarian operation. Our Moscow correspondent Tom Barton has the latest.
Ukrainian security spokesman really responding with outrage to the Russian convoy beginning to move over the border. And that really is a reflection of all the work that the Ukrainians have been doing with the Russians and the Red Cross and OACE to try and get a passage of those trucks secured with checks, because the Ukrainians were not satisfied that there was enough evidence provided by the Russians that those trucks were A, not trying to smuggle weapons to pro-Russian rebels in the east of Ukraine, and B, also potentially could somehow be used as a pretext for a Russian invasion. And that is now exactly the fear that they say. They say they won't attack these trucks, but they do say that that is exactly the scenario they had wanted to avoid.
Russia argues that this convoy passage is actually in line with international law.
Yes, they have said that in a statement. They haven't explained quite why. They've used the humanitarian context in that same statement, which would imply that they've said that the humanitarian situation warrants this action. That is something that Ukraine rejects in what they say. But then also, we've got the phone call that's reportedly happened between Russian President Vladimir Putin and Angela Merkel, the German Chancellor, where he has reportedly said that, quite simply, they couldn't wait any longer.
Right. You're one of the few people who can actually answer this question. What's in them? What's in these trucks? You've had a look.
Well, I can answer that for about a dozen of them. It was about a week ago when a group of journalists, myself included, were shown inside around a dozen of those trucks. I must say, one impression that stuck with me was how empty a lot of the trucks were. But of the cargo that they were carrying, there were things like grains, like buckwheat, bottled water, some sleeping bags and tea, things like that. So of the cargo that we were shown, around a dozen out of about 270 trucks, it was humanitarian aid. It was there to help people. And Ukraine itself has in recent days said it does accept that, on the face of it, this convoy is a humanitarian convoy. But the problems arise with what might actually be a subsidiary role for this convoy, or what may transpire out of it just driving on into this contested and very dangerous territory.
A high-level meeting penciled for next week between President Putin and his Ukrainian counterpart Poroshenko could now be jeopardised after these events. But that is meant to be going ahead next week.
Indeed it is. There is already talk that potentially this incident could put those talks at risk. if they go ahead, it would be the first time that Petro Poroshenko has met Vladimir Putin face to face since June and D-Day anniversary events in Normandy, when they had a brief conversation with each other. This time, it would most likely be a lot more difficult, and would be possible to skirt around the issues. And the reports are that would be an attempt to try and de-escalate the situation. And it's also been said that Ukrainian President Petro Poroshenko will directly ask Vladimir Putin to try and de-escalate the situation, stop supporting pro-Russian rebels with heavy weapons, with other kinds of support that Kiev has consistently accused Russia of providing across the border. And it is very likely, though, given past comments, that Russia will carry on denying that it is providing that help.
FSN's Moscow correspondent Tom Barton. This is FSN Reports. The execution of James Foley amounts to a terror attack against America. The message from the White House today as an official investigation was opened into the US journalist's brutal slaughter at the hands of IS extremists. The United States, however, was quick to point out that crushing the wider threat of the Islamic State requires a united international response.
This group didn't grow up overnight. They didn't get the capabilities that they got overnight. We've been watching this for a while, and then we all recognize it's going to take a while. But it's going to take a while for everybody, not just the United States military. And the secretary was clear about this yesterday. You're not going to see the answer to all ISIL problems through a military lens. We're a component. We're a tool. We are conducting operations inside Iraq against this group in support of Iraqis and Kurdish forces. But we're not going to be the only tool in the toolbox that can or should be used.
Pentagon spokesperson John Kirby speaking on Friday. For more on how the murder of James Foley could influence the US response to the jihadist movement, FSN's Lorna Shaddock spoke to Max Hoffman, a policy analyst with the Center for American Progress.
The video is shocking. I don't think it will affect U.S. policy decisions in that, you know, it won't affect the decision whether to continue airstrikes. If that was ISIS's goal, it certainly will not happen. What it will affect, however, is U.S. public opinion. You know, the American people are deeply ambivalent about getting potentially dragged back into Iraq. But this video will underscore just how awful the ISIS threat is, and there'll be a great deal of anger amongst Americans, which may, you know, solidify support for the president's actions, particularly the airstrikes.
Yeah, you mentioned the airstrikes there. Could it even become a situation where public opinion is almost calling for the president to do more and to increase those airstrikes?
I don't think so, only because Iraq is really a poison chalice in American politics, because, you know, our long involvement there, the fact that we lost so many American lives there and expended so much American treasure trying to piece the country back together. Granted, a country that we broke in 2003. So there's some sense of responsibility to prevent Iraq from falling apart, but the American people do not want to see ground forces, and I don't think they want to even see a sustained air campaign. If the air campaign is demonstrated to be very effective and is contributing towards stability, they'll put up with it. But I don't think anyone wants to get more involved.
What about, though, certain Republican politicians who have been using this either to criticize President Obama for not doing more sooner or now to say more needs to be done?
Certainly the John McCains, the Lindsey Grahams, the more hawkish wing of the Republican Party have been calling for some time for greater involvement. I think many of them would have liked to have seen the United States stay in Iraq and never leave. It's important to remember, though, that there are two parts to this equation. The Iraqis didn't want American ground forces to remain. And there was no chance that the American army was going to stay as an occupying force long term. So I think that would be my one response. I don't think you'll see those criticisms go away. The hawkish wing of the Republican Party will continue to criticize. But most Americans see those people and see the people who got us into Iraq in the first place in 2003 and are not listening, frankly.
And is this, because ISIS was a threat not just now, it was a threat 6 months ago as well. These kind of brutal videos were already in existence 6 months ago. So is there an argument for saying this is kind of a little bit too little too late?
I think that is certainly the sort of the most valid criticism of Obama's foreign policy. I think the intelligence community and the U.S. administration were very aware of the ISIS threat and were taking steps quietly to combat it. But I think that because of our history in Iraq, there was a reluctance to maintain the sort of covert and surveillance resources we needed there. So yes, I think the fall of Mosul in particular caught the U.S. somewhat off guard. So there may be a valid criticism there. But the other thing is there were two clocks running that affected the timing of American action. The first was we didn't have the intelligence surveillance resources. We didn't have blanket surveillance of northern Iraq, so we couldn't target airstrikes even if we'd wanted to take them. The second was the president was very, I think, effectively using the potential of airstrikes to pressure Maliki to step aside and pressure Iraqi politicians to come together and form a unity government. That's frankly the more important that political track is frankly more important in the long term. So the president used the possibility of airstrikes very effectively. I actually think the timing there was well done.
What now then, in terms of the timeline? He's been very careful, President Obama, not to put any kind of end date on these airstrikes or indeed the humanitarian mission. But what do you see in terms of his longer term strategy here, given the public opinion against getting involved in the long term?
I think we're entering the harder phase. It was somewhat easy for American air power to stop the ISIS advance in conjunction with Kurdish Peshmerga fighters and Iraqi security forces. Now to try and roll it back, it'll be much more difficult. And I think we're in for a bit of a long slog. ISIS is deeply embedded in Anbar and in Mosul in the north. And the political compromise is not there yet in Baghdad. Hopefully they'll bring in Sunni tribal leaders. They'll be able to form a coalition against ISIS that's willing to push these fighters out. But it's going to take time, and the U.S. can't do it for the Iraqis. So this is the harder phase from a political standpoint. And just as a quick addition, also the areas we'll be trying to push ISIS out of are areas like Mosul and Fallujah, deeply populated urban environments where there are civilians, the possibility of civilian casualties. It becomes very, very tricky.
And meanwhile, of course, there is the European angle on this. Many European countries concerned about the number of their citizens going to Iraq and Syria as part of ISIS. How much do you think President Obama should be working with those countries, or what kind of strategy might there be in those terms as well?
I think the U.S. is working very closely with both European partners and partners like Jordan and Turkey and even Lebanon to try and track the flow of foreign fighters and try and insulate against those people with Western passports filtering back out and perhaps launching attacks. Certainly the executioner in that terrible video spoke with a London accent. It's deeply troubling, I think. It underscored that threat. But I think the efforts are primarily at the intelligence, at the covert level, to try and insulate. Unless you're willing to go into Syria in a very big way, I don't think you can yet hope to stamp out the source of these problems. You just hope to contain them for the time being.
FSN's Lorna Shaddock with Max Hoffman, a policy analyst with the Centre for American Progress. Now, for a clearer picture of what is happening on the ground in northern Iraq, LBC's Nick Ferrari spoke to Oliver Harvey, chief features writer for the Sun newspaper, who has just returned from the front lines in Iraq. Nick began by asking him what aspect of the story would stay with him the longest.
I just think the terror of the people that are fleeing in this Islamic State. You wouldn't believe it. They just ran. They picked up their belongings they could carry and just ran. And we're talking millions of people, millions of fellow Muslims fleeing these. They're just the terror in these people's eyes. That's what's going to stay with me, I think.
What is daily life like for them now?
Well, Kurdistan, the bit I was mostly in, has sort of been a fairly safe haven in that region for quite some time. And life in the big cities, in the capital, Erbil, certainly is getting back to normal. But they've taken these hundreds of thousands of people who are living, they're living by the side of the road, literally. Thousands of people in camps, in this 45 degrees heat, in sanitary conditions and all the rest of it. So not terrible for the refugees.
Where do you see the story going next, Oliver?
Well, it's not going to go away anytime soon, is it?
Is it the domestic angle now? Is it the possibility that some of these British nationals will try and get back? Is it what Obama seeks to do? Is it whether we, unfortunately, are going to see... Do you think we'll see more videos of these jihadists with American or other citizens being held at knife point or even being beheaded?
I hope and pray not. I think, obviously, there's... I was interested to hear one of your previous conversation about how many Brits are over there. I spoke to a general with the Kurdish Peshmerga.
Yes.
And he said he shared intelligence with the Brits and Americans. And his people in the captured villages said they heard British accents in the villages that ISIS have captured. And I said, what sort of numbers do you think? And he thinks 400 British jihadis.
Right.
His estimation are still are there, you know. But as far as where this goes, they now control this de facto state the size of Great Britain,
good God, it's
with a population thing. Bigger than Denmark. So, you know, this is in the heart of the Middle East with oil wells. They've got their own,
yes,
revenues from oil now, which they sell on the black market. People are buying off them.
And lastly...
They're not short of cash.
No, I know. Indeed, they're trading in oil, aren't they? Just lastly, Oliver, where do you think the British military stands at the moment? There's enormous reluctance from the Foreign Secretary, from David Cameron, to put what's known as boots on the ground. Do you think that will hold?
I think you could see the comments coming from government that they were sort of testing the water to see the reaction to more military support. I mean, I think the British soldiers are already there, to be honest.
Yes.
There already are boots on the ground. What willingness will be to take that any further, I don't know.
Oliver Harvey speaking to LBC's Nick Ferrari. And finally tonight, FSN Spotlight. And with that, here's Simon Marks.
Today on FSN Spotlight, the accessibility of culture. The singer-songwriter Kate Bush is about to return to the world of live performance, 35 years since her last full-length concert. Times have changed, and she knows it, which is why her plea to audiences this week not to bring cell phones and iPads to her concerts and then use them to take photographs and videos seemed to many to be so anachronistic. She argues that she wants to communicate directly with concertgoers and not have a layer of technology between them. The use of smartphones with their inbuilt cameras has been making news in another corner of the art world this week, as Bender Grosvenor, an art dealer and historian, notes in this commentary for the Financial Times.
2 years ago, when I was feeling unusually well off, I sent an email to a senior figure at the National Gallery in London to propose a deal. "I'll donate £10,000 to the National Gallery," I wrote, "if you lift the ban on photography in the main galleries." I'd just witnessed an uncomfortable scene in the gallery's Room 1, where a newly acquired painting by Titian, Diana and Callisto, was on display. A hapless tourist, caught in the act of raising her iPhone towards the picture, had been aggressively shouted at by a gallery warden, his "no photos" startling everyone in the room. The visitor, her moment of wonder at Titian's painterly genius shattered, was visibly shaken and left. I felt for her, not only for the brusque treatment, but because, as an art historian and dealer, I recognise the urge to photograph a great work or capture the brilliance of a particular brushstroke. It's rare to find good high-resolution images online, and usually, taking a photo on a phone is the discreet work of a moment which disturbs no one. Postcards from the shop are never good enough. It seemed ridiculous, too, that the public had just paid £45 million for its new Titian, but wasn't allowed to photograph it. And I've been campaigning against the ban ever since. Our tourist's mistake was understandable, for many major museums already allowed visitors to take photos, such as the Metropolitan in New York, the Louvre in Paris, and even the Royal Collection at Buckingham Palace, just a short walk away down the Mall. These forward-thinking institutions, accepting that nearly everyone now carries a camera in their pocket at all times, had come to understand that smartphones were not something to be feared, but tools to be used to their advantage. If you want to reach younger audiences, an image of a painting shared enthusiastically on social media makes for more effective marketing than any outreach campaign. When the singer Katy Perry recently tweeted a selfie in a Magritte exhibition to her 55 million followers, she gave the Chicago Institute of Art the sort of publicity a British museum might kill for. Unfortunately, that wasn't the last case of warden shouting I saw at the National Gallery, and although other UK museums came to allow photography, including the neighbouring National Portrait Gallery, it always seemed that the National would hold firm, much to the relief of traditionalists who saw it as the last redoubt of museum civilization. So I was pleasantly surprised to be able to break the news on my blog last week that the National Gallery would allow photography after all. Now the National spoke of seeking to enhance the experience of our visitors and to engage a broader audience. And to help do so, they were providing free Wi-Fi and mobile-friendly websites. In one leap, they had gone from lagging behind the museum sector to leading it. For some, however, the news seemed little short of catastrophic. Two main fears were raised. First, headlines in The Times and the London Evening Standard spoke of a deluge of photographers ruining the gallery's atmosphere and disturbing true art lovers. For these nose-holding culturati, there are a few things more repulsive than a selfie. Secondly, the Guardian newspaper, always keen to tell its readers how to consume culture, said photography should be banned in galleries entirely, so that we may look at art more closely in what it called the old-fashioned way. I must say, I have some sympathy with the first concern. It has never happened to me, but being nudged by an iPad when you're mid-Rembrandt must be irritating. Sadly, there have always been inconsiderate gallery users, even before photography was allowed, and we must accept that the scrum in front of popular pictures like Van Gogh's Sunflowers will be just as deep as it always was. The use of flash, even though it is prohibited by all galleries, does seem to be an issue at this early stage, but don't believe the myth that it damages paintings. Perhaps the National Gallery's wardens will shout at the flash sinners just as eagerly as they used to berate camera users. But the second objection to photography, that people must be forced to look at art in a certain way, is merely patronising and, though I hesitate to use the word, elitist. Being told that your way of understanding art is wrong is like going to a restaurant and being forced to hold your knife and fork properly. In any case, how long should we look at a painting for? A minute? Five? Or an hour? And from how far away? A foot or a yard? There is, of course, no right answer, and we can never know whether a photo taker is seeing a painting for the first time or is there for a repeat visit. Probably the great Peter Paul Rubens, when he made his own copy of Diana and Callisto in 1628, studied Titian's masterpiece more closely than anyone before or since. But I bet he'd have taken a photo if he could. Actually, in the long run, I think photography will encourage a much closer analysis of paintings, especially if it is accompanied by an abolition of image reproduction fees. The high cost of these fees has acted as a choke on the study of art history for too long, producing only text-heavy books with few illustrations which hardly anyone reads. Liberate the images, and people may begin to look at art in a new way. The National Gallery never responded to my email, and maybe now I owe them that £10,000. Either way, I congratulate them for coming through on their part of the deal.
The art historian and dealer Bender Grosvenor in a commentary for the Financial Times. It's online at ft.com. With FSN Spotlight, I'm Simon Marks.
And that's the Friday edition of FSN Reports. If you'd like to get in touch with the show, email us reports at featurestory.com, and you can follow us on Twitter. We're there at featurestory. But for now, I'm Kevin McAleese in Washington, alongside Rebecca Foster with The Bulletin. For everyone with FSN everywhere, have a great weekend. Goodbye.